Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. Joining me today is Jess Braven. He's the Supreme Court correspondent for the Wall Street Journal and the author of The Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay. He's been covering the use of the Guantanamo military commissions, the alternative to using the traditional criminal justice system for suspected terrorists, since 2001. Jess, welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure.
Well, let's start with some basics about where we are today with these commissions. They're still going on, correct?
Oh, absolutely. They're now their third iteration. First, President Bush had a military order he issued in November 2001. Then there was a congressional act in 2006. And then President Obama added his own revisions in 2009. And that's what we have today.
And how many prisoners are there right now, and what are their statuses?
Well, there are about 140 prisoners at Guantanamo Bay, but no more than a third are actually expected to be prosecuted by military commission, which, as you say, is like an alternative court system for enemy aliens. The other people held at Guantanamo either have been cleared for release and are really stuck in a kind of diplomatic limbo, or they are in this middle category of neither cleared for release, nor is there enough evidence to charge them.
And in your book, you write a very provocative sentence about the origins of these commissions. You say this: in effect, today's military commissions are the legal equivalent of a war of choice. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's because none of the people who have been slated for prosecution by military commission would not be prosecutable in civilian court. In other words, I've asked throughout this project over the decade plus that I've covered it, is that, you know, but for military commissions, would this person walk free? In other words, would it be possible to charge him in a federal court or in a court-martial, which is a, you know, a military court that we've had for many years? And the answer is no. Any of these people could have been charged in an existing federal court or court-martial. So really, this is a legal experiment that exists for its own benefit.
And tell me more about what you mean in terms of what the other alternatives would have been. And so what are some of the, I guess, the choices in the decision tree that led to going one way or another there?
Sure. Well, you know, after 9/11, the horrific attack on our country, the Department of Justice expected that it would take the lead in the legal retribution for the attack, that if the suspects behind it were captured, they would be prosecuted in federal court, and the Department of Justice prepared a plan with listing which offenses had been committed or, you know, could be charged, you know, where, you know, how to do it and so forth. Well, you know, the things that you would expect them normally to do. And in fact, no one in the government, at least on the level of actually fighting terrorism, the CIA or the military or the Justice Department or what have you, none of those agencies expected anything different. They all assumed that that's what was going to happen and that's what they were prepared to do. But at the top levels of the Bush administration, there was an interest in reviving this dormant form of military justice that the United States last had used during World War II, called a military commission. And it was a real top-down idea that to create a separate trial system that would be apart from the existing justice system, primarily in the way that it would answer only to the president. It would be walled off from the federal courts. It would exist outside of congressional authority, and it would answer solely to the president, who would have the last word on whether a defendant was selected for trial and whether his conviction would stand, whether his death sentence or other sentence would be commuted. It would all just be part of the president's own executive power, have nothing to do with other branches of government. So that was the initial idea for the experiment.
And why did they want that so badly? That may seem like a obvious question, but why did the administration want to do it that way?
Well, there were a number of explanations that were given. Often they said that it was this is the type of justice that these people deserve. That's what Vice President Cheney said shortly after President Bush announced the plan in November of 2001. And a few different explanations were given but they all were sort of circular explanations. Federal courts aren't appropriate for people like this. Why? Because they are not of the same category as normal defendants for whom federal courts are appropriate, like that kind of explanation. Really, my reporting showed, and I don't think there'll be a lot of and people in the administration really explained it, they viewed the establishment of military commissions less as a practical solution to a problem, in other words, what are we going to do with these people, than as a way to demonstrate the president's power in responding to a threat to the United States. The point was really to set a marker and say the president has and is entitled to have and should have complete flexibility in doing whatever he thinks is necessary to respond to the terrorist attack, including trying and punishing enemy belligerents as he sees fit through a system that answers to him as part of his war-making power. And in other words, so it was a top-down idea as opposed to saying, gosh, what are we going to do with these people? We have – our current system is incapable of handling them.
Was there any kind of more from a justice perspective, criminal justice perspective, a more theoretical or a more objective case for having these commissions as opposed to employing the regular criminal justice process?
Well, the argument being that the 9/11 attack is an act of war. It is targeting civilians, which is a war crime. And so therefore, since the type of people we have in mind for these commissions will have committed violations of the laws of war, they should be in front of a tribunal that enforces the laws of war. And military commissions, traditionally that has been one of the functions of certain types of military commissions historically. So that would have been the rationale. And in fact, the idea itself originated long ago after the hijacking, and that's I'm sure very familiar to your listeners, of Pan Am 103 in the 1980s, which of course was exploded over Scotland. And that that attack, the suspected perpetrators were hiding in Libya. And the Department of Justice at the time, the first Bush administration, was trying to think of what it could do to get a hold of those suspects. And one of the ideas was, if they captured them outside normal legal process, in other words, they had some commando raid or something like that, they didn't extradite them from Libya or what have you, to get around any kind of legal challenges, they could set up a military commission and try them that way as sort of saboteurs. That was really an idea that was explored and rejected because the British and the Scottish, who were also involved in that case, weren't interested in doing that. But that's where it originated, and some of the people who were involved in that planning in the 80s resurrected the idea right after 9/11.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Jess Braven, a law correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and the author of The Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay. I want to pick up on the last thing that you were just saying. It sounds to me, though, like some of these folks could be perhaps better regarded as prisoners of war than suspects. Can you speak to that?
Well, you know, one thing that many of us got right after 9/11 was a crash course in the Geneva Conventions and different categories of the laws of armed conflict. And prisoners of war turns out to be a term of art, as they say in the law. It means a specific type of prisoner under the Geneva Conventions. And a prisoner of war, POW, or as the U.S. likes to call them, an EPW, because to distinguish enemy prisoners of war from our own service people who are captured by the enemy, they are not being punished. A prisoner of war held by us or by an enemy is not being held to punish them for wrongdoing. They're being held in preventative detention, basically, to stop them from fighting. But it's actually not a violation of the laws of war to kill enemy soldiers. In fact, that's what a war is. So you can't punish the enemy soldier for shooting at your soldiers. What you can do is incarcerate them to stop them from doing it. But the rules of the Geneva Convention and so forth are not supposed to be punitive, and prisoners of war are supposed to be given certain privileges because they're, as long as they are, have not violated the rules of war, which then makes them a war criminal.
So we wanted to go beyond that treatment then, it sounds like.
Well, the president, and this was a controversial decision, he declared that no member of either al-Qaeda or the Taliban would qualify as being a prisoner of war because they didn't meet the criteria that the Geneva Convention spelled out. And there wasn't too much dispute among legal authorities about al-Qaeda being a terrorist organization. Taliban was a different story because they were an armed force that belonged to a country, even though not a country that we had much respect for, not a country that behaved very politely. But they were its de facto military, and they did seem to operate as a military organization. So there was more controversy over whether the president could simply categorically withdraw those protections from them. But that even though the Geneva Convention has another provision separate from prisoners of war known as Common Article 3 because it's common to all four Geneva Conventions. And this is basically from the view of legal authorities, the catch-all provision. Anyone who isn't given a certain type of protection under the treaty a privileged type of protection as a civilian or a prisoner of war or other categories. The catch-all section is known as Common Article 3, and it puts out very basic protections that everyone is supposed to have. And the most controversial aspect of the Bush policy was to say even that does not apply. And that, of course, was the Supreme Court held otherwise in 2006.
And as I read some of the criticisms of these commissions, it seems to me that there is a kind of a catch-22 aspect about them, that either they work pretty well and they're respectful of the rights of the accused and of a fair process, in which case then it suggests this question that I've been sort of putting at in different ways to you, which is why have them instead of a normal criminal court process, or you need to be able to go outside of what we consider appropriate justice procedures, and then we're left wondering, should we be doing this? Is it legal? Is it right? Does it fit the convention and those kinds of things? Do you see that in thinking about this?
Well, you know, the place where we are now is it's one of these things where I don't think there's anyone in the government who's paid attention to these this project that would have chosen to be where we are now, because it really doesn't meet the objectives of anyone who was involved in originating it or of the Obama administration right now. For instance, the goal of the Bush administration, to the extent they ever expected to actually have a trial, was to do something quick and dirty. In fact, the term rough justice in the subtitle of the book is a term that Bush officials used in private conversations to explain what it was they were after. They had in mind a particular trial in 1942 where eight Nazi saboteurs were rounded up, very quickly tried in secret, and six of them were sent to the electric chair within months. That was the model they had in mind. If nothing else, it's efficient. That's not, of course, what we have. It took 3 years before the first pretrial hearing began at a military commission. It took 7 years before the first trial took place in a military commission. And that trial's appeals just ended in October with the conviction being reversed by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. So they have not proven to be very efficient. Another goal was to be was to scrap the rules of evidence that usually apply in federal courts and also in courts martial. The original rules of evidence would let anything in, including statements taken from torture, hearsay statements, anything that the prosecution wanted to get in and that the military commission concluded was probative, meaning they wanted to hear it, could get in and get used. And that's, of course, not the case in regular courts. Normally, for instance, a defendant gets to question a witness against him. That's confrontation right. That wouldn't exist under the initial conception of the Bush commissions. All right. So if there were things the government was doing to get information that they would prefer people not know about, and we've since learned what some of those are, you could get that in and use it to convict somebody and even potentially sentence them to death without exposing how that information got out there and without really getting a sense of how reliable the information is. But that all that was scrapped by the Supreme Court in 2006, which found it was not permissible under federal law or treaties the United States has ratified. It was not consistent with fair trial rules. So the 2006 statute and then the 2009 statute made at least the rules on paper considerably more fair than they had been originally envisioned. And in fact, if you talk to the military today, they will be very critical of the first Bush version, and they will hold up the current version as being very, very fair, almost as fair as a civilian court or a court martial, which then, Grant, of course, brings up the next question is, well, if it's 93% as fair as a federal court, why bother? Because even if on paper they look fair and even if many of the people who work in them are very principled and responsible professionals, there is the fact that they are untested legally. And many issues that we know the answers to in conventional courts remain unresolved in military commissions.
My guest is Jess Braven. He's the Supreme Court correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and the author of The Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay. Now, let me pick up on this topic we were discussing before and just ask you this question then simply. Then if the original vision was this really quick trial with a fast resolution, what went wrong? Why are we still now in this very long process?
And one thing that happened is that you know, once the U.S. began capturing higher-level al-Qaeda officials, the interest in the government was not so much prosecuting them for their past wrongdoing, but interrogating them and gaining intelligence and so forth. And it's, of course, been widely reported how brutal some of the techniques that the CIA used were, waterboarding and all kinds of other methods, which have been repudiated by the current administration. Those kinds of techniques were things that the Bush administration did not want to see emerge in court. And as a result, even after the intelligence value of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and other top officials had apparently been expended, they kept them in these secret CIA prisons known as black sites because bringing them into trial, even a sort of abbreviated trial, risked disclosure of some of these actions. The Bush administration, though, had no choice really after 2006 when the Supreme Court said that the minimal protections of the Geneva Conventions apply even to someone like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, meaning you can't waterboard them and so forth. So they were then brought to Guantanamo Bay, and a slow process to prepare for trial began under a new form of military commission act. 2008, pretrial hearings had begun, but because the system was untested and had all kinds of quirks that had not really been thought out, it ground to a halt, most interestingly, when they tried to plead guilty. The rules had been imported from the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which has certain protections within it, and among the protections are, a military defendant can't plead guilty to a capital offense. So when Khalid Sheikh Mohammed tried to do that, being quite proud of his self-confessed master achievement of the 9/11 attacks, the military judge had to stop the proceedings and ask for a briefing on the matter of could he even accept a guilty plea to a capital offense. Then Obama came in, stopped the whole process to begin reviewing it, turned it over to the attorney general, who concluded these people should be tried in federal court because really it's not that hard a case since they say they did it and there's plenty of evidence. There was a political uproar, and that the politics delayed the trial again, went back to the Pentagon, and now it's begun once more. There isn't much debate really over whether these guys are going to be convicted or whether some, you know, heretofore unknown suspect will, you know, emerge in the back of the courtroom and say, "No, I did it. These men are innocent." I mean, that's no one expects that. What we do expect, though, is a lot of litigation over how much the government has to disclose over what it already did to the defendants when it held them in CIA custody. And the main main thing that we are going to learn as this trial goes forward is whether the military courts and then above them the appellate courts decide that government misconduct in its abuse of these prisoners before they were even charged with a crime is so egregious that it takes the death penalty off the table for one or more of the defendants.
Well, before I ask this next question, I need to issue a listener warning. Some may find the information that follows offensive and not suitable for children, but I did want to pick up on something that you mentioned before. You mentioned the waterboarding and you said other techniques. And although we've heard already a lot about the extreme interrogation methods that have been used, and we've debated in this country whether they amount to torture and whether that is acceptable or unacceptable, some of the things still that your book reveals are even given all that, I think, shocking and bizarre. One prisoner, for example, beyond being subjected to the physical abuses that we're more familiar with, being taken to a room covered with images of female genitalia and having female interrogators rub their breasts over his body. I think even a cynic might have a hard time stomaching the idea that their government, as a matter of policy, engages in that behavior. So my question was, what was the single aspect of everything that you found that shocked you the most?
Well, you know, I'd rather put it in terms of what shocked the main character in the book the most. The book's main character is a Marine officer named Stuart Couch from North Carolina, who was a very experienced prosecutor and a Marine pilot and a friend of one of the 9/11 victims. In fact, the co-pilot on United 175 was his buddy from his squadron when they were in the Marines together. And Stuart Couch signed up to prosecute terrorists, you know, for the patriotic reasons we'd expect a career military officer to want to do that. But as he got into these cases, he discovered that government misconduct infected many of the cases against the most serious suspects that he had at Guantanamo Bay. And one of them was a prisoner named Mohamedou Ould Slahi. You can look him up in the 9/11 report, which describes him as the guy who recruited Mohammed Atta and other members of the Hamburg cell in the 9/11 hijackings. And Slahi was treated as the highest value detainee at Guantanamo for a period, and the military intelligence units went after him as hard as they could. And he was abused in many, many of these ways. Couch concluded that it was torture, and as a result, he had to junk the prosecution. But the thing that for Couch tipped the scale, the straw that broke the camel's back for him, was when there had – when intelligence agents put together an elaborate ruse really trying to play on his psychology and the fact that Slahi was very close to his mother. So they set up a ruse in which they explained to him that his mother had been taken captive by the United States and would be brought to Guantanamo Bay and placed among the male population and gang raped if he didn't cooperate. And Slahi felt that this was an un-American technique that was beneath the dignity of anyone. And for him, that plus everything else really undermined the moral case that the United States had.
In case you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations, and I'm talking with the Wall Street Journal's Jess Braven. Well, in another interview that you gave, you made a provocative statement about how and why information about these things comes out, even though people try to keep them secret. You said there are no such things as secrets. They're only delayed disclosures. So will we ever know everything that went on there, do you think?
You know, I also have to credit that to another gentleman who's a character in the book, a NCIS agent named Mark Fallon, who was the deputy chief of investigations for military commissions. He was one of the military investigators who first raised a warning flag about torture going on in 2002. And he tried very hard to stop it while it was happening, not only because he felt it was illegal and immoral, also because he felt it would damage the chances of prosecuting people because evidence that's obtained illegally can't be used in court. And they're very good. It's not, and that's not just a idealistic, aspirational fact of law. There are practical reasons why certain things are illegal and why they can't be introduced. And the NCIS is an agency that's known for very rough tactics, even in peacetime. Nevertheless, for him, this was going too far, and he tried very hard to stop it. And he warned other people at Guantanamo Bay that they should not expect these things to remain secret forever. He wrote in one email, "This is the stuff that congressional hearings are made of." And he's the one who said, "There are no such things as secrets; there are only delayed disclosures."
Do you think that we, as a nation, will look back on this experience and collectively conclude that we should have done things differently, similar perhaps to the way we now see the internments of Japanese citizens in World War II, say?
Well, one of the other, I think, surprises of the way that the military commissions aspect of the detention scheme has gone, and this is really a subset of the whole detention scheme, is that as questionable as some of the rules have been and as tainted as some of the decisions have been, the actual outcomes in the seven cases that have gone all the way to conviction, you can't really say are unfair or look bad compared to what civilian courts have brought in similar kinds of cases. Most of the seven cases that have gone to the end through military commission were resolved by plea bargains that led to the release of the defendant after admitting guilt. So – and then serving for a year or 2 years, a relatively short period of time. So they are getting off much more leniently than people who have been charged with similar offenses in civilian courts, which routinely hand down 30-year sentences, life sentences, very, very harsh sentences compared to military commissions. The first trial, the only one that was contested and went all the way to the end without a plea bargain or other sort of default by the defendant. As I say, that was a conviction for an offense called material support for terrorism, which was just vacated by the – or vacated in October by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals because it said that's not a war crime and military commissions can only try war crimes. So I don't think – I mean, this is – you know, both critics and advocates of the system, I think, were surprised that this is how it turned out, that when you actually get to the end of one of these processes, you find that the military – the career military officers who have been in charge of it have, you know, when having to come up with a just result certainly can't be criticized for having shirked that responsibility. So it's not really like the Japanese internments where we had masses of people totally innocent rounded up from their shops and homes and dragged off to the desert for no reason other than pure racism. This is a different animal, and it's easier to understand what the concerns that the government had. On the other hand, the Japanese internments lasted for a few years during World War II and then were ended, and now this is now in year 12, and it seems that there's no way out for the United States in with the 140 or so people who are at Guantanamo Bay. It's like they're sort of frozen in amber.
And before we get to the three questions at the end, I have to ask you a question based on another book of yours on a completely different topic. The book is called Squeaky, The Life and Times of Lynette Fromm, Squeaky Fromm, the Manson follower who pointed a gun at President Ford. She was released from prison a few years ago, and I've read that she's living in Marcy, New York, not too far away from here. Have you followed her life post-prison at all?
You know, I have not followed her life post-prison. I mean, when she was in prison, she and I corresponded and spoke on the phone when I was working on the book. And she was not excited about me writing that book to begin with. She felt she had not been treated well in earlier press accounts. And in fact, she didn't even cooperate while I was writing the book. It was only after it came out where she told a reporter that it wasn't as bad as she'd expected. I then wrote her, and she responded. And we had she essentially gave me a critique of the book, which I then used to sort of write an afterword for the paperback edition, going over what she thought was right and what she thought was wrong. But I will certainly give her credit for this. Unlike a lot of people that I write about, she was very able to distinguish from my function as a reporter and sort of the messenger and the information provided by different sources. So things she thought that were not accurate in the book, she blamed them on the people who told me those things, as opposed to blaming me for having some kind of agenda against her. So that was a level of sophistication about the way the news media at least thinks it works that I have to say isn't shared by everyone, including people in some very powerful offices.
Well, let me get to the three questions at the end. First, what's the title of the chapter of life you're currently living?
Lost in Space.
Second, what's your worst trait?
Hesitation.
And finally, what professional or creative achievement in your life so far has surprised you the most?
I cannot believe that the Los Angeles City Council actually went along with my plan to name the intersection of Hollywood and Coenga Boulevards in Los Angeles, California, Raymond Chandler Square, after the great novelist, author of The Big Sleep and Farewell, My Lovely.
That was Jess Braven, and his book is The Terror Courts, Rough Justice at Guantanamo Bay. Jess, thanks so much for talking with me.
This was great. Thanks so much.
For a longer version of the interview you just heard, go to WRVO.org, and please also join me again next week on WRVO Public Media for more conversation in the public interest.